year's Eurelectric Power Summit in Athens, policy implementation to spur the energy transition was a hot topic, especially in light of European elections taking place this year. For a candid talk about policy robustness, my colleague and Brussels editor Areti Ntaradimu took in some fresh Athens air with Marcus Raramu, President and CEO of Fortum and Vice President of Eurelectric. Raramu stressed the need for a technology-neutral approach to delivering Europe's energy transition policy and targets. He also reveals why all available tools are required to decarbonize hard-to-abate sectors and ensure Europe's industrial competitiveness. I'm Pamela Larg, and this is the Energy Transitions Podcast.
Marcus, we heard the Prime Minister of Greece yesterday in his keynote here at Eurelectric Power Summit telling us or describing us the small miracle of PPC. This was a company, the most important energy company in Greece, actually, that was almost bankrupt less than 5 years ago. And within a small period of time, with robust and favorable policy, together with funding, of course, it became a healthy company that not only does well here in Greece, but also outside. They have managed to score some collaborations that are quite important for the health, let's say, of the energy sector of Greece. Now, my question to you is, European policy, EU Commission policy, I've heard many CEOs saying that sometimes it can be an obstacle instead of an incentive, of a help. What's your position on this?
Yeah, thanks, Areti, for the question. So it is important that Europe is setting ambitious policies, and it is paving the way for other regions and countries in the climate ambitions. But then when the ambitions are set, we should make sure that all the tools available, meaning technology neutrality, is applied so that we don't restrict ourselves. We don't tie one hand behind the back when trying to achieve these goals. So policies is important in target setting, but then we should allow all the available tools to reach it.
But where do we find that silver lining? I mean, a policy is a policy, and once it is voted upon from European parliaments, once it becomes a law, how much can we bend, let's say, the law?
Yeah, when the target is to decarbonize the energy system, decarbonize the production of steel and chemicals and data centers and battery factories, then we should allow all CO2-free energy production forms to exist. And when Europe sets the policy targets, sets the emission reduction targets, then in my opinion, also the available tools should be used. And then I mean EU institutions like EIB, for example, and make sure that EIB and other institutions are funding all CO2-free projects. And we don't start to make exclusions and thus restrict our ability to reach these goals.
A thing that is closely connected to policy is security of supply for the energy sector. And I know that Fortum is quite interested in this topic. Can I please have your first thoughts, taking into consideration two wars that are very close to our borders and the issues that we have been faced with during the last couple of years?
On the security of supply, you can take two different levels. One is the robustness of the system. And what we see today and what we've heard here at the summit from several speakers is that renewables are penetrating the system with increasing speed. And that's great. We get a lot of low-cost, affordable megawatt hours into the system. But from our point of view, we see a lot of demand. Actually, the steel, chemicals, data centers, battery factories, these typically require close to 24/7 availability of energy. So volatile intermittent energy is not something they can easily deal with. And thus, from a security of supply point of view, we need firm capacity and we need flexible capacity. And this comes back to the financing, making it possible actually to build also dispatchable CO2-free capacity. The other side of the security of supply is, of course, then the physical and cyber disruptions. And Ukraine is a very, very stark example of what can happen. We heard from DTEC's CEO that 90% of their capacity was taken out several times. Then we talk about really serious physical security of supply. From that point of view, in Europe, we could actually pool our resources together and make sure that we know where equipment is available. There are components, transformers and others, which may take half a year or 2 years to get new ones from OEMs. But for sure, we could have a lot of replacement assets available in Europe to keep our whole energy system running.
Exactly. But what comes to mind is that about a decade ago, there was a complete shutdown of the energy sector of Ukraine, something we have not seen during the war, which makes me think that perhaps our cybersecurity measures are sort of working. Would you agree?
Definitely. We have seen in our company that cyber activity has increased and penetration attempts are daily and several. And indeed, so far, knock on wood, we have been able to keep the systems running. But that means that we need to have increased vigilance and cyber counter capabilities, for sure. But the attempts are daily.
Yes, I believe that. I had a discussion with TenneT, the Dutch TSO, and they told me exactly that the attacks are almost daily and that their offices are like Fort Knox. That's how, let's say, protected they are. I would like, however, to circle back a little bit because you mentioned storage. Now, here at the Power Summit, we heard a lot being said about renewables and entering renewables in the grid. The grid is not fully prepared for them, perhaps, so storage, which is in any case important, becomes even more important. I would like your thoughts on that because... Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think we have the correct storage facilities anywhere or enough in Europe.
That's right. Nowhere close to what is happening today and what we expect to happen in the future with the renewables penetration. The way we are addressing that in large scale is that we are investigating pumped hydro. So then in the Nordics, we talk about several hundreds of megawatts per unit potential. So this is initial feasibility studies, but in the total scale of gigawatt size in total. In the short term, we have been already for many years, we have been building batteries. But if you think about, for example, the Nordic conditions, then it's not about dealing with the daily variation, but more how do you deal with the seasonal variation. And that's when large scale things like pump hydro come into question. The batteries we have been using for grid services, supplying inertia, down regulation, up regulation. So that is more for the short term. Works, of course, very well, a battery solar wind combination in the sunnier areas where the problem is more the daily variation. How do you deal with the day and night?
So would you estimate that in Europe we're, let me put it this way, in a good path when it comes to integrating renewables and storage facilities, etc.? Will we make the 2030, 2050 goals?
The way things are going right now, there will have to be massive demand response from consumers and industries if we don't do something else than what we are doing right now. And that gets me back to the how do we get firm and flexible capacity to the market. And I go back to the heavy industries demand increase, steel, chemicals, data centers, battery factories. So these do require close to full load electricity. And then we come to things like new nuclear. So the question is that what can we do to provide uninterrupted CO2-free power?
Exactly. And you mentioned nuclear, which is a cause of debate here in Europe. We have the example of France that has fully embraced it. And we have the example of Germany that has fully, almost, said no to it. What do you think? I know that this is a difficult question to actually take position on that, but let's say, which country would you affiliate yourself with?
Yeah, so our company is mainly operating in Finland and Sweden, and both countries have a long tradition in nuclear, and we are doing a new build feasibility study for new nuclear. So we are looking at both conventional and SMRs. And the question is exactly this, that where do we get firm capacity for stable consumption?
So I think it's clear. We're following, let's say, France's way. To be honest, speaking of SMRs, I was at another summit in Rome, the SNETP summit, and SMRs were really the talk of the town, let's say. Can you please elaborate a little bit and tell us how safe they are? Because this is something that everybody is interested in. How economical they are, and how fast can we create enough so that we potentially can make our goals?
Yeah, SMRs are definitely something that that a lot of people are talking about. In our study, we are actually looking at both conventional large reactors and SMRs. And this is a two-year study. And I would say that already the halfway conclusions are that there are actually series produced large reactors today. So the modularity concept applies to the large reactors. There are a handful of suppliers who have series built these. And that's a key thing for the economics. This is the key idea with the SMRs, to be able to series produce and thus get the cost down. Normally, you would think that that the larger unit is more economical per produced unit of output. So logically, SMRs should not be as effective. But the thing is that then you can use more standard components, turbines, generators, pumps and valves. The difference is that the large reactors are in the market today. So you can go and see a reference plant, how it works, what are the performance KPIs. But for an SMR, the first commercial ones will be ready somewhere in the end of this decade. So as a power producer, if you want to see a reference plant, you have to still wait for a few years and then start deciding how you go about it. So SMRs will be, from my point of view, a solution for the late 30s. If you want to get something done by the mid-30s, then you have to go large conventional.
Fair enough. Let us not forget that according to the EU Commission's taxonomy, nuclear is green, is renewable, so it should be part of the equation and the discussion when we discuss renewables. However, since we need to wait that long for that, and since we can, I think, already agree that when it comes to renewables and renewable energy production, we are a little bit behind from our competition. I would like to ask you how competitive you think we are. In February, we had the publication of the so-called Antwerp Declaration, and it was about industrial competitiveness. So I would like some first thoughts from you, if we're still in the game or not.
It's a very serious question for Europe. What do we want to do? And exactly, the Antwerp Declaration was basically a kind of a reality check, a wake-up call from the energy-intensive industries. Europe has been very dependent on low-cost but imported and fossil fuels, and a big part of that has been coming from Russia. Now Europe changed that dependence to dependence on spot LNG.
Exactly, which again is not the best solution perhaps, and again we will be a little bit dependent from other countries like Norway or Azerbaijan, right?
That's correct. So this is a short-term solution. But in the long term, and you're correct that, for example, new dispatchable firm capacity, that is some years away. But you got to start working now to get to where you want to be in the mid-30s. So there's no reason not to go ahead. And then I go back to the EU institutions and actually utilizing the tools we have. For example, EIB to finance projects that are difficult to finance otherwise. You take nuclear construction time 10 years. These are the challenges that EU can actually address. Renewables can get financing from the bond market, bank market. Construction times are short. Technology is mature. So that isn't difficult to get financing for. But things like pumped hydro, nuclear, these are the places where we really need to take a stand and decide, what kind of an electricity system do we want?
And the Nordics are a very good example of the kind of electricity that perhaps we would want the entire Europe in the future. And Fortum is also a fine example of how to do things the Nordic way. So I would like to ask, if you were to talk to a colleague of yours from the South, and in the South we do things perhaps a little bit differently, what would you advise them to do and what would you ask them?
Today, Fortum's production is 98% CO2-free. And in the Nordics, we have strong nuclear. We have one of the world's biggest hydro resources, a lot of biomass. So the energy system is clean, grids are robust. There's a possibility to grow. But this was not something that somehow came from the sky to us. We have had big coal condensing plants. We have been using coal and gas in the system, but very determinedly, we faced that out over the last 20 years. So my advice would be that you have to start moving towards a goal, implement that in a determined way, have the policies in place, both restrictive and incentivizing policies, and it is possible to get there. Same thing applies for the waste sector, where we have been engaged in. When I was a kid, every community had a place in the forest that was called a landfill. And today, only 1% of the waste in Finland goes to landfill. All the rest is recycled. So it is possible. During my lifetime, that has happened. And I'm not that old.
Perfect. But there are, however, some differences. I would like to stay a little bit on this so-called North-South diversity. Another, let's say, difference between the North and the South is that of digitalization. The North is very much digitized, whereas in the South, there are areas that don't even have a smart meter. How can we cope with that? Because Europe is one. We can't have, let's say, Europe of various gears.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So digitalization is an enabler for the renewable penetration. And in the Nordics, the prevailing contract type for consumers is a spot contract. And demand is responding to the volatile prices because smart meters have been rolled out to all households and they're even being upgraded. So the intelligence in the meters enables all of this. If you take Finland alone, we have had prices varying in the last few months, varying between minus 500 euro per megawatt hour up to plus 2000 euro per megawatt hour. And the consumption flexed rather easily, plus minus 10% during these days. So absolutely, enabler. And then the whole, coming back to what would be the advice and looking at what we have been doing. So yes, we have been deploying large renewables. Now in Finland, there's 7 gigawatt of renewables in the system. And then on the demand responding side, we have been electrifying, for example, district heating. And simultaneously, when we deploy large wind parks, we are building electric boilers to produce district heating. And that doesn't have to be produced every hour, every minute, exactly the required amount, but you can store the hot water. So this is a good combination of demand and supply.
Markus, if you had a magic wand, and you could change one thing, be that policy, be that, I don't know, the minds of the people when it comes to nuclear, what would you choose?
I would actually activate all of the EU institutions to actually be aligned with the EU policies and targets. We have some of the biggest institutions in the world. The biggest banks are the EU, European Investment Bank, EBRD. So if we just use the tools we have, we will improve our chances of meeting our targets a lot.
And if you had the opportunity to advise Kadri Simson about one thing only, what would that be?
Technology neutrality.
Clear message. Thank you very, very much, Markus.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Energy Transitions Podcast, brought to you by Enlit and Friends. That's a wrap from me, Pamela Log, and our producer, Kamo Motse. We hope you can join us next time. Visit enlit.world or subscribe for more episodes.